episode 4, Blade Runner.
I know! I'm so excited!
Sweet. Yeah. I'm Mr. Bowen. That over there is At The Fro.
Hello!
And we're here to talk about the AFI Top 100 movies, of which we are now going to watch number 96.
Blade Runner!
Blade Runner!
Yes! Alright, so, Blade Runner, the specific Blade Runner that we're going to be watching is the 1982 theatrical release.
Yes.
And that's the one that apparently has this, a studio-mandated happy ending, and a, what was it?
A studio-mandated voiceover narration that was in an earlier version of the script, but then was cut out before they started production.
Oh, okay.
So.
And I also heard that apparently the rumor is that Ridley Scott directed Harrison Ford when they were doing the voiceover to just deadpan it so that the producers would be like, this is so terrible that we can't keep it in the movie.
There's two versions of that story. One is that Ridley Scott directed him to do that, and the other is that he just decided to do that on his own. I'm more inclined to think, based on some comments that he made in 2006 about, Harrison Ford made in 2006 about really not wanting to do the narration because he thought that the film was fine, and he thought that it would work.
Yeah.
And I'm inclined to agree with him. I think that the director's cut, without the extra, the footage, the unicorn and all, whatever, that didn't make any difference. I think that the film worked without the narration. Now, it may be that I have seen the film so many times that the film worked without the narration simply because I already knew what the narration was, and I didn't have the benefit of having seen this film without the narration the first time.
And
but that said, I think it's a strong enough film to hold up without the narration. And as yet, I have not met someone who has not seen the theatrical version already, who has not, except for maybe I think Art Harpy. Oh, wait. You?
Yeah. I haven't seen the actual theatrical version. I've only seen
Well, then, there we go. But you've seen version. You've seen the version without the narration.
Yeah,
which
I have.
Thought was...
I thought it was okay. I mean,
it was okay.
It was a science fiction movie that came from the 80s. So, you know...
Well, there is that. There,
it's the same... I don't know. It's the same decade that gave us great science fiction movies like Demo Man.
Demolition Man?
Demolition Man, yeah.
No, that was in the 90s. So,
was that in the...
No, the 80s gave us sci-fi classics like E.T., Buckaroo Banzai, Adventures Across the Eighth Dimension.
It gave us
also Time Riders and Solar Babies.
Oh, God.
And it gave us Battle Beyond the Stars, although that might have been 79 or 78. But I don't think... I remember watching that on TV earlier than the 80s, so it would have come out, and that was, you know...
Well, when you fly a ship that has space tits on it,
It also gave us Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, it did.
And Jedi. And it gave us, all kinds of things. Time After Time.
Oh, God.
So there's a huge, as there is today, there's a huge swath of crap and good stuff. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Yes.
Came out right around the same time as this movie.
Really? Oh.
Yep.
That's interesting.
So what we have here, though, and what I think really resonates with people is that you have a sci-fi noir. Mm-hmm. You have a film that if you somehow were able to pull the science fiction references out of it. Okay,
yeah.
So it's about replicants. It's about, you know, basically it's about androids. It's about all this technology in the future, and we're in a dark place. But it has the noir elements. It has the dark, brooding atmosphere. It has the put-upon detective who is carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders. He is, you know, in the noir films, they tended to be war-weary veterans who came back to do, you know, to do police work or to do private detective work or something like that. There was always sort of this backstory thing. So we don't have a lot of that with Ford's Deckard. But we do have we can see the world weariness on him.
Yeah.
We can see that he's got the lack of sleep, that the pollution is weighing on him, that he doesn't have a great place to live, that everything is artificial light, and you know, you can barely see the sun anymore because of the pollution there, and it's raining constantly. And there's this mix of humanity that has come together in this world of futuristic Los Angeles, which, by the way, folks, isn't that far away anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, we're way closer to it now. I think I'll verify it when we watch, because we're doing this part before we watch the film. Then we're going to come back and talk about it after we've watched it again. But we're talking, what, 20 years from now?
Yeah.
That this is supposed to be set?
Yeah.
And it was made 30 years ago. Actually, 30 years this year.
Woo!
So 30 years ago, this movie came out and was this vision of the future 50 years from now.
Yeah.
And like, oh no, this is terrible. But hey, look at all the things that they have. They have
robots and pollution.
They have buildings.
Oh,
that are skyscrapers like we have now.
Yeah,
that are playing advertisements on them.
Oh yeah.
When this movie came out, that was like a glimmer of hope in some marketing executives. Just the back of the brain.
That might be a good idea.
There were very few places on the planet at the time. It was kind of, well, Tokyo was probably a good example. Of what, you know, because they had the neon and they had the, you know, and but the building sized billboards that we see now that we take for granted, like, oh, we've released a new Bourne film, and there's the building that has
the
40 story banner on it of the guy's face, or the you know, that kind of thing. That has now, that's a reality now.
Yeah. Not you that know. Weird for us.
We don't have blimps that are floating through the city with spotlights on them.
Yeah, but we do have playing advertisements trucks.
That are playing advertisements, and they had advertising trucks then too, but I mean this is a, you know, a giant floating blimp thing with with a talking TV advertisement on it and an ad for Coca-Cola. So we're gonna take notes when we watch this thing. We're going to dissect it a little bit more thoroughly. Andrew's going to talk about the source material, Philip K. Dick's classic novella.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
Novella, yeah, a short novel.
About 150 pages. It was pretty concise.
Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be back in about 2.5 hours, so don't go anywhere. All right, so, wow, okay, so we just...
I would like to make a declaration. I want my entire life now to be backed by... That's what I want with my life now.
Some keyboards, a little bit of...
Like somebody has taken a saxophone and murdered it, and then played that back... And then put, like, some kind of, like, auto-tune kind of stuff going on. Yeah.
Okay. That's fair. That's reasonable. Oh, and I have to amend my earlier statement from just a couple of minutes ago, although I did make it several hours ago.
Time.
The film actually takes place in 2019.
Yeah. Which is so, not that far
gosh,
off.
Gosh, that's what... 6.5 years from now,
as
we're talking, that's not a lot of time for Los Angeles to become a dark, rainy city with gas fires and gigantic pyramid-shaped buildings.
Well, then it'd be
and
like
flying
Seattle.
Cars, flying cars,
lots of flying cars,
because that seems to be the future for all of us.
More flying cars,
cars that can fly and drive.
Themselves.
And run around, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds
I guess only the police cars are the ones that can fly. His car didn't fly so much.
Yeah, he drove like a Geo or something like that.
He did look like, kind of a...
Those things are indestructible, so, you know. So that was quite a movie. I mean, I do not understand kind of what the hubbub was about like how the movie is, you know, very, very different in multiple ways. I mean, I've now seen two versions of this. Apparently there's how many? Seven?
There are officially seven versions of the film.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Including the TV version where they cut stuff out.
Yeah, but that's...
Right.
Yeah, that's like the censored version of, I don't know, Star Wars, or actually... Yeah, never mind. And I was expecting, like, seeing the narrated version, like, to be, like, this, like, huge narration, you know, throughout the entire thing.
That was over everything.
Over everything.
And strangely enough, I mean, I know I've seen this film a dozen times or more, and I remember the narration being more narration than there actually is in the film.
But it's like, but instead...
But can you also see now, I mean, you've seen the version without, and you've seen the version with... The stuff that's in the film, the narration that's actually in the film, because there's really only like seven little, I didn't count, but I think, as I recall, there's only like seven little things that it says. They're all explanations of, like, stuff that's very obvious from what's going on the screen.
Yeah.
So you can see how if it's dumped back out, it doesn't, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's just like, and then I went to go make a sandwich, you know, as he's narrating making a sandwich. So it's that
know,
kind
I don't
of
know
stuff.
That it was quite that obvious. There was some information that he was giving you, but there's also some. The interesting thing about noir narration is that it rarely ever actually gives you any information, any new information.
Yeah.
If you just let the characters speak, or if you let the characters act and show you what every, you know, that's the thing about voiceover narration. That's when you're writing a screenplay, the advice is show, don't tell.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you are writing a voiceover about something, and it can be used very effectively, but it's kind of a crutch. It's kind of a, like, oh, we didn't make this clear enough, so now we have to go back and record a thing that says, so this guy's the kind of a guy who back in the olden days, you know, it's like, well... Yeah, but, okay. So, it's interesting to me also that in 6 years, I'm going to be older than Deckard's character is in the film, which means that he was born, you know, the Deckard was born in the 70s.
Yeah.
And grew up and then became this police officer and stuff, because I figure he's probably 40-ish in the film.
Probably. Well, how old was Harrison Ford when he did the role?
You know, I don't know.
No, you don't?
I don't know.
That's fine.
But I'm just saying that kind of, he's a 35-ish, 40-ish person, and you know, it's just this weird, like, this is not, when this movie came out in the early 80s, in 82, that you had this sort of sense like, wow, this really could be 45 years in the future. This could be what we're living in.
Oddly enough, it's still actually...
Because you don't think in terms of, well, that's going to be, I'll be 47 when this, you know, that kind of year, or I'll be 40, I'll be almost 50 years old when this, when the time period, it's like, that's not math you do in your head when you're 12.
Yeah, that's true. Deckard's conceivable that, you know, Deckard could have seen a movie that was like this and, you know, lived his life and, you know.
Deckard would have seen Star Wars on video.
Yeah. That's kind of...
Time-wise, Deckard would have seen Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's true. But I find it very interesting because, you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, when you first saw this movie, did these seem like all the stuff that you saw was like this fantastic, like, impossible future? Or was this...
This movie? No.
Yeah. No?
When I saw Star Wars, what I saw was a future, although it takes place in the past.
Very far away.
And a very long distance away. But I saw a future that has already seen its peak.
Yeah.
You've already seen their technological heights, and they're starting to go down, you know, they're starting
downhill,
to go down the downhill side of that particular mountain.
Yeah.
Because everything is very technologically advanced, but breaking down.
break it.
Things
broken,
can
dusty.
Be shined. Things can be wiped off and shined.
Yeah.
But they've passed their glory days.
Uh-huh.
This film, Blade Runner, takes our present and ages it and then adds to it an aspect of future.
Yeah.
So, for instance, when we're in the toy maker's shop, his home,
Sebastian's house. Yeah.
Sebastian, J.F. Sebastian's home. He's in a building that has long been used. The location itself has long been used for location shots in movies. I mean, it goes back to the 40s in early noir films, and it's in a lot of those. It's in, you know, films all through up until and then after this movie was made.
Yeah.
And so they took that, and at least for the staircases and the elevators, which are the wrought iron type. So they took that
building.
And they threw dirt and water and muck on the floor. It shot it at night or, you know, in the dark.
And darkly lit.
With lights that are flashing in. So it has a different and very surreal look to it. But it's like our world has then progressed forward and we've lost power and we've had to restore it with battery-operated fluorescent camping lights.
Yeah.
Or that kind of thing. But at the same time, you've got this room that he's in that is old, very, you know, thick-walled architecture. It's a very old building. And then he's got this doctor's work light that's like 3 feet by 3 feet with you know, half a dozen bulbs or more in it.
Yeah.
And it's hanging over his dining room table where he does work.
Yeah.
He's got modern kitchen appliances or even futuristic kitchen appliances. He's got that egg boiler thing that in the background.
I think that might have just been a beaker.
Well, it's a glass tube.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be boiling eggs.
Yeah. You know, well, it's very obviously a water jet, but you know.
Right, but it's but what it is in actuality doesn't matter so much as what it's supposed to be. It's
really good.
You know, the walls are rotting and there's water everywhere because it's raining all the time and there's holes in the roofs and there's these floor-to-ceiling cupboards and things and all of these very old-style, you know, built in the 30s.
Yeah.
And now it's almost 100 years later.
Yeah.
And it's all falling apart, but there's still this modern, you know, there's still this futuristic thing about it. They threw some neon on there, and if neon in the movies, especially in 80s movies, neon means the future. Unless it's a movie about the 50s, and then it's about the nostalgic past.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. So it's
the future past, so to speak.
Kind of, yes. But that's kind of a, it's... You know, things like neon, things like that's a shorthand for future. It's like,
gotcha.
Tall collars.
Tall
on jackets.
Tall collars. Seriously.
I don't know why, but for some reason, through the late 70s and into the 80s, if you had tall collars on whatever it was, or stand-up collars.
Mantles.
You could, it's very much a future thing.
We're in the future.
I mean, even if you go as far as Aliens.
Right.
Where all the suits are regular cut, except
these tall collars.
The weird collars that come up. They're not,
Well, they're, It's really weird. You know, it's kind of weird because, you know, having seen this movie, you know, what is it now, 30 years later? You can kind of see now where that's headed, that we're kind of headed that way, sort of. Maybe it's not a completely perfect thing, but like you said earlier, the billboards. I mean, there's technology right now that we can have those moving billboards.
Yeah.
You know, it's not readily available, but it's possible.
Yeah.
And the thing that really, that kind of freaks me out is that, you know, if there weren't things like... you know, like the Clean Air Act or, you know, that kind of thing, would we... Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, the stuff that was going on when that movie came out is kind of... That movie was kind of the end of what was kind of starting to happen in when that movie came out. I mean, like, everything was really dirty, and things, you know, it rained all the time, and the pollution was just, it blotted out the sun, and then
so,
that kind of thing.
So you're, so also, so beyond being a science fiction film, it's also a statement, an environmental statement?
I believe
so.
There's not really a
message that comes across.
Well, I
don't
think,
necessarily.
I thought it was a little odd that you couldn't see the sun unless you, you know, left town.
Well, yeah, that's true. So there were a couple other things that I wanted to address about this film that really kind of hit home in the sense that, you know, we are in the midst of, well, right now we've got the friggin' 3D, everything is trying to be 3D extravaganza, whatever.
The headache glasses?
The headache glasses, the room full of the IMAX. The IMAX not meant for viewing motion pictures that are... Yeah, never mind.
in this world of horror perhaps, that we have...
Perhaps another podcast for that. So, this film has special effects. It's obvious that there are matte paintings.
Yeah.
And there are model shots.
Very beautifully done, though.
And they're very well done. Most of them hold up.
Yes.
There are a few that don't.
Yes.
And there are a few, I think, that don't stand up to repeated viewing on video, DVD, media, that kind of thing. They're definitely effects that were designed to be seen in the theater maybe a few times, but not something that... This movie wasn't designed to be taken home and consumed ad nauseum forever. Partly because of the way it was... for when it came out, first of all, and because, you know, that the home media thing wasn't really... It wasn't a thing yet. So there was partly that, partly because I think that there's a style of a movie making where, you know, you want to... This is a movie you're going to see in the theater.
Yep.
And it's designed to be seen in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
And you see split-second things.
Yeah.
Like, there's a couple of shots where the spinners, as they're called, the police cars, are, you know, either rising or lowering off a street, onto a street. And you can see... You can very clearly see the cable...
Oh, yeah.
That is holding these things, you know, in the air.
Yeah.
And the rain kind of masks it, and it's one of those things that I've seen this movie so many times now, I kind of know what to look for. I know, you know, where the things are, and I got, oh, there's going to be a cable in that thing. And in that sense, it doesn't hold up to the repeated viewings.
Yeah.
The gas jets at the very beginning of the film are... The plumes of fire that are shooting out of the refineries at the beginning of the film. The panorama itself is striking.
Yeah.
You know, it says Los Angeles, 2019. That fades out, and you see as far as your eye can see.
Yeah.
It's essentially the classic Los Angeles photo, or the Los Angeles cityscape at night.
Yeah.
From the hill that you in the movie, you know, whenever there's a power outage in Los Angeles in a movie, you always see it from a hill, and the power goes out, and it's grids and boom, 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 and everything goes out. And then, so this is that same kind of vantage point.
Yeah.
And you're looking out over the lights of Los Angeles, and they go even farther than they already do. They're as far as the eye can see, one side of the screen to the other, off to the horizon, and... The whole landscape is dominated by these gigantic pyramid shaped buildings.
Yeah,
and you're doing a slow flyover towards them, and it still has this power to it. That's like, here it is. This is the future, and now it's only 7 years away. So you know, get ready. The gas jets at the beginning are a little bit more, you know, it's a little bit more clear that they're a weirdly compressed special effect, which is
It was. I thought that was. There were a couple
they
of
shot it in Cinerama and then squished it down to a.
I think that it can definitely be said about this film that there were seams. there were definitely, you could see the seams in the special effects and stuff like that, but, you know, other than that, you know, it was a really gorgeous looking movie.
It worked,
I mean, it holds up. I mean, I was impressed.
The design works, the design, you know, there's elements of old, there's elements of present, there's elements of future in it.
Yeah.
There's that it all holds together in this cohesive blend. It's so nice to be able to sit down and watch a 30-year-old movie and not go, oh, here we go again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which I guess technically we've kind of said now for all four of the movies we've watched. Like, oh, we're gonna. Oh, I really enjoyed that. But then I guess that's why it's on the list of the top 100 favorite movies of all time. You know, that's why this is here, and it's one of a very few number of sci-fi films.
Yeah.
Apparently, the Blade Runner is also number 6 on the top 10 list of sci-fi films from AFI, which is cool. I would certainly rank it pretty high on my list of at least sci-fi films.
Yeah.
It also goes into the noir category. I mean, you put it up against Maltese Falcon or you know, any number of other noir films, and you've got a good, you know, just suck the color out of it. Just make it black and white, and you're there. You know, bam, there you go.
Yeah,
you know.
If anybody asks about the
Richard Widmark, and
if anybody asks about the glowing umbrellas, just say reflection.
Hmm. Okay, so that actually the glowing thing reminds me of an effect that is in the film that's kind of surprisingly. That it's so effective, and there's so few places where it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But there's a lighting effect in the film where all the replicants have these glowing eyes.
Yep.
Now, today, you could easily just pay a digital artist, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars, and they go in and they'll rotoscope the eyes in there. And they could have done that at the time. I mean, that rotoscoping definitely, I mean, lightsabers were already a thing, laser beams and things like that.
Yeah, you could do all that stuff.
Painted into the film. But this was a very low-tech solution. You basically take a light that you use to... I mean, it's a classic Hollywood thing. You light the eyes so that you get an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that a lot, especially in black and white films.
Yes.
But you want to highlight the eyes, so there's a light there. Okay, so you use a light, and you shutter, you gate it down.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very narrow focus.
Yeah. Now,
so you see that with Sean Young's character.
Yep.
You see that with Daryl Hannah's character.
Yep.
And with Rutger Hauer.
Yeah.
All of the replicants.
Though I think this might actually contribute to the theory that Deckard is a replicant because he walks behind
Sean Young in one. And that's
one
where
scene,
the effect didn't work.
And he looks
back
at her,
the camera,
and his eyes are glowing.
Because
and it's like
that's what happens when you have a low tech effect. If somebody gets into the shot, you're going to see that effect on everybody.
Yeah.
And honestly, if that's why people think that he's probably a replicant too, I don't know what to say to that because, for one, okay, so I just sat through this 2-hour film again.
Uh-huh.
I've watched it from the beginning to the end. I have seen the extended version. I have seen the non-narrated version. I have seen this version I don't know how many times.
I've seen warships burn.
And
I don't
see the Deckard is a replicant thing.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I have for years. If you know out there in podcast land, email 100ofsomething@gmail.com
and explain it to us.
Let us know. Please, just explain it. If you don't know, but you know somebody who might know,
send the podcast to them. Send them the link to the show.
Yeah.
And then have them email us at 100ofsomething@gmail.com.
We would really love to know.
I would love to hear what you have to say. Now, of course, I could Google it right now. I could just sit here. I could Alta Vista it.
No.
I could ask.com it. I could do all those
things. You
could
Bing the shit out of it.
I could indeed. I could Bing the shit right out of it. But what I am saying is that I have just watched this film, and when it ended, I looked at it and I said, you know what? Nope. I don't see it.
Yeah. But I think...
No, the unicorn in the film doesn't count. That would be in the extended version of this thing, the freaking unicorn galloping whateverness.
What does that have to do with anything?
It ties in with the paper... The origami characters that Edward James almost leaves.
Right. So Adama leaves a unicorn and suddenly the main character's a robot. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Internet.
Yeah, so the fro over here, about halfway through the film, he turns to me and says, "Where have I seen him before?"
Referring to James.
Edward James almost. And I said, think about it. He's about 30 years older. The last time you saw him, he was about 30 years older than he is in this film.
Well, the thing is that...
and a couple minutes later, you know, we got the head slap moment. Oh, okay. So, yeah. Because he was looking at the facial hair instead of the scarring.
Yeah.
And once he realized that's what he was looking at...
It's hard. You can disguise someone really well with a mustache. I'm just
you
saying.
You really can.
You really can.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, So there's the challenge there. You know, if you guys understand why maybe it's subtext that I've been missing for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something.
Oh, you know, it might have
something. Maybe it's something that somebody suggested after the film was done and in the can for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, and they said in an interview once, well, he was really a, you know.
He was really a replicant.
Yeah, let's retcon that, and let's make that what the movie's actually about instead of what the movie was actually about,
which is
not that.
Yeah. Which
clear?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Okay. Well, it might be the same thing as kind of just like, here's a way to think about the movie, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off was all in Cameron's head.
That, yes.
Something like that is just like a way to think about the movie.
Yeah, but that's actually supportable.
That is true, yeah.
And if that was on the 100 list, then we would talk about that film in great depth, because I love that theory.
Yeah.
And maybe we can do a side thing on that one at some point.
I love that theory.
So anyway, the Decker is a replicant theory. I don't love it.
Yeah.
I'm not too happy about that. So, okay, so you wanted to talk a little bit about the book.
Yes, okay, so...
And the differences between the book and the movie. Now, bear in mind... It is an adaptation.
This is true.
And they are different things. And we've had this discussion many times, and if we have to, we'll have it again. But it is a different thing.
I understand that. And, you know, it has taken me a very long time for me to understand that, you know, movie adaptations of books are a completely separate entity. If you are complaining about the canon in a book that didn't happen in a movie, you're doing it wrong. So, the thing is that, there are a lot of, both the book Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick and the movie Blade Runner are both set in these fantastic worlds. I mean, a majority of the movie is just spent world building. And, you know, they do the same thing into Androids Dream of Electric Sheep.
We're going to come back to the world building.
Okay. But the thing is that, you know, there were a couple of things that, you know, kind of made it a little bit more futuristic in the book. I mean, there was first of all, Deckard was married. The thing is that, you know, there were a couple of things
now,
like...
Yeah. Was he... actively married. Was his wife a character in the book?
Yes.
So he had conversations.
Yeah, he had conversations. There was a device which I thought was really awesome that was kind of a way of kind of controlling the masses. It was an emotion machine. And there isn't really a way to describe it other than it's a keypad that that distributes drugs. You punch in a keypad, and it would give you a certain emotion, and you would inject it into yourself, and you would feel that. Now,
cool.
Yeah, it's
no wonder everything's broken down.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a machine, and like there was a conversation towards the beginning of the book, which I remember just fantastically. He was having this conversation with his wife where she didn't want to take her injection because it was like a compliant, I don't want to leave my husband. It was like drug number 4,787, I don't want to leave my husband. And basically he was forcing her to take it.
Wow.
Yeah. So Deckard wasn't exactly a...
So she giving her 100 cc's of it'll be better in the morning?
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much, and that was one of those things. One of the other cool things that I really enjoyed about the book that wasn't really in the movie, they touched on it a little bit in the movie, that animals are scarce. Real animals are scarce.
Yes.
And they make replicants to sell to people. And replicant and the animals in this world are really rare and they're really expensive. Deckard actually in the book carries around a little. What is it called the blue book for cars?
Kelly's Blue Book.
Kelly's Blue Book. There's a Kelly's Blue Book for animals.
Oh
yeah, and he's basically spends the whole book like trying to get enough money so he can replace his electric sheep. Which, you know, having a live animal is considered a status symbol. It's something that, you know, you are keeping up with the Joneses kind of stuff. Like, if you have a live animal, you are, you know, rich. You are just rich.
Right.
But everybody
and live animal meaning not a replicant.
Not a replicant.
Okay.
Yeah, and...
So it sounds to me like what you're describing here is that his electric sheep...
Yeah.
...was obviously electric.
Yes. Well, sort of. The thing about the replicants is that you couldn't tell the difference.
Oh, okay.
Until you popped it open and you realized. There was... Well, Sebastian, there was a character that I cannot remember the name of right now, but there was an equivalent character who was a repairman for those animals. And
that sounds very much like the Sebastian character from the film as well.
Yeah, he would repair those animals, and there was a scene where he found a cat because, you know, the cool thing about the animals is that they had these realistic malfunctions that would make them seem like they were sick and they were dying.
Mm.
He found a real cat, and he killed it. By accident.
Trying to fix it. Oops.
He popped it up. He tried to pop it up.
You know, I was just going to ask you if you popped your. What if you forgot?
Yeah.
That you you can't just pop open your non-electric sheep.
Well, that's the thing is that you know like the.
It's an interesting choice though too. I mean, a sheep as a pet.
They were
even if it's fake.
Yeah, I mean the cool thing about the Kelly Blue Book is that the Kelly Blue Book for the synthetic animals was that you know you could look through it and you could determine how expensive something was, and you know a sheep was mid range, and you know that was kind of like a middle class, like it would be kind of like the equivalent of you going out and buying a BMW.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, it's a relatively expensive thing for you know a middle class individual. But, you know, you can still do it, and you can still afford it, and you wouldn't, you know, people wouldn't be like, oh, are they maxing out their credit cards to do that kind of thing? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, it was one of those things that I really kind of liked, that it was like, this is the new BMW, this is a new Keeping Up with the Joneses, and I really liked that in the book, that they didn't really, I think they had one throwaway line that's like, of course it's, I think they were talking about an owl or something.
There's a couple, yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple.
The owl is not real. And then if someone gave you a calfskin wallet,
yeah, I would report
them to the police and have them arrested.
That's right. The other thing is that killing an animal is considered a crime because they're just so rare.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, and the it was just like, oh, also Blade Runners, they were policemen, but to kill a replicant was considered like a bonus thing. Being a Blade Runner was your job, but you got a bonus every time you killed a replicant and turned him in.
Right.
And, yeah, it's...
So
it's,
kind of a major... There's a major subplot of the book, though.
Yeah.
About killing humans
and turning them in as replicants, or
it's kind of touched on that, you know, there's been occasions where people have to kind of con the system to turn in humans as replicants because, again, you can't tell the difference unless they fail the test.
Right.
And they've even said in the book that, you know, it's not 100% effective. It's not always right. The only reason why they use it is that, you know, I think it's like 55% of the time we actually catch a replicant.
Right.
So it's a pretty easy test to fool. And it's just, it raises questions. I mean, how much control does the company have that, you know, they're allowed to continue making more and more advanced robots when the police are hired to actively hunt them down when they become dangerous?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
So it's corporations kind of running amok.
Yeah.
And that doesn't sound at all familiar with today. I mean, you couldn't possibly say that Dick was in any way, you know, prescient about that.
Nope.
foresaged the rise of the corporation. Or even, yeah. I mean... Even in those days, I don't think they had any idea how powerful corporations could become.
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Anyway, but,
Hey, do you think there's a Voight-Kampff test for corporations to see if they're people? Or did they already pass that one?
That needs to be made. I would like to see that now. I would like to see that made immediately.
Get to work on that, internets.
Please.
Away with you. Away with you, internets.
Okay, so you said you wanted to come back to the world-building aspect.
Yeah, okay, so you said something about the book and the film spend a lot of time world-building.
Yeah.
The film, I think, does it in fairly subtle ways. You know, mm-hmm. part of it's the narration. Part of it is the, you know, going to... Well, just... The first time we see Deckard, he's sitting under an awning in a busy street.
Yeah.
He's reading a newspaper, and he goes across the street and orders noodles
and some sushi
and, you know, a couple of pieces of sushi and a bowl of noodles. And so we immediately know from that. The culture that he's living in that has become... Because they've already identified that it's Los Angeles.
Yes.
And you can see the signage and everything is in multi-languages.
Yeah.
People are shouting at each other in different languages. So we have a very mixed melting pot society that has been built...
kind of the inevitable of what is inevitably to happen with...
Globalization and, you know, trade and everything. So we have that. Obviously, there's pollution everywhere.
Yep.
He's tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get that from body language.
Yeah.
And the rain that is so prevalent in this helps to bring your own emotions down.
Yeah.
Having that there, seeing that and having that always be raining.
Yeah.
You look at it and you go, whew, you know.
He's like,
it becomes an emotional touch point for you. You're looking at the film and going, oof, it's raining and it keeps...
It's still going.
It's still raining and it's dirty and this stuff. And you start... And yet, people are still moving on with their lives. The closeness of the city, it mimics Asian cities a lot. Like I mentioned earlier, Tokyo. A lot of other cities in and lots of just crushing population. Lots and lots of people. And moving all different directions, traffic is snarled.
Yeah,
traffic is stopped. They have the craziest intersections. Though I think every intersection in that film is the intersection of at least 7 streets.
Yeah, that's true.
They seem to cross more streets.
Yeah,
in their chase scenes, just walking across from one corner to another, they cross like 4 streets, which is incredible. Especially since there are very few cars.
Yeah,
lots of bicycles.
Yes,
which,
that's true.
You know, in the future, that's going to be a thing, you know, with the scarcity of fuel, with everything else.
Well, I was thinking it was weird, and then, like, there was a scene with the main antagonist, the main replicant. He was, you know, had a conversation with a guy who makes eyes, and then they walked out, and then just a fleet of bicycles just came flying in. Just like, what the f- what?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, and that also, you brought up a point while we were watching the film saying, was genetic, was that like...
A buzzword.
The buzzword.
Like tachyon.
And yeah, very, actually, yes, genetic in that film is very much like tachyon in any of the Star Trek...
Yeah.
The Star Trek films or...
I'm a genetic designer. What does that mean?
I'm a genetic designer, I'm a genetic engineer, I make genetic eyeballs, Yeah.
What?
If you throw genetic on the front of it...
It's futuristic.
It's futuristic. It's another... It's like putting neon... If you can't put neon on engineer.
Actually, a neon engineer is a real job.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
But still, you know, so you have that... you have that sort of... It's a buzzword. It's guys... Yeah, people are... Oh, genetics.
Genetics.
We don't know what you... I mean, this is before... This film was made well before...
Yeah.
We had... mapped the genomes for so many
Yeah, the
things.
Human Genome Project.
So we don't have... We nobody knew what, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, we knew what we were looking for in that time. Yeah. We had, you know, inklings and ideas, but we didn't have the raw computing power. We didn't have the ability. We didn't have the funding.
Yeah.
So all these things have happened since then, and genetic is now part of, you know, parlance. We're talking about genetically modified corn and genetically modified this and that and the other thing, and don't put it in, and don't bring it to my supermarket and stuff. And this film was like, genetic!
Woo! Genetics!
I've got to make toys. I'm a genetic engineer who makes toys.
Oh, God.
And one creepiest... Oh, there you go. Okay, so along with the world, you also have... How much could this film have benefited from... CG, just in the scenes where there were toys.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I say that, and you might think that I would be in favor of someone saying, let's throw some stuff in here.
Uh-huh.
But I am not. And I think that the fact that they used little people, or dwarves, or, you know...
Stunted individuals...
Oh, jeez. Okay, so I was trying to be careful, but now I guess that's out. They put people in costumes and then had them on the soundstage where they were shooting these scenes.
Yeah.
And they were draped with stuff, and they had dust, and they had weird, you know, they had makeup on them, and they would do something every once in a while, and there would just be an arm movement.
Yeah.
But it was very obviously a person.
Mm-hmm.
Who was, and that fits with the, they are replicants, so they shouldn't be, they should be indistinguishable from humans.
Yeah.
Except that they don't do, they aren't doing things that normal humans would necessarily do. Sitting in one place, arm goes up, head goes to the side.
Yeah.
Head goes back, arm goes down again.
Yeah.
You know, the dolls, you know, doll motions, human-sized. Played by a human instead of today, we'd probably get a CG something or other.
No, I think I would
there'd
go.
There'd be no head on it, or there'd be a.
I'd do animatronic.
Half
for
of
that.
A thing would be gone.
Well, I'd probably, you know, carve. I'd probably remove half the face. Just actually, you could do that just with makeup.
Just in your thing.
You can't see it right now, but I am giving him the biggest death glare I can. I'm killing you with my eyes.
I'm dying.
I know.
All right.
You better be.
So, moving on from that, you mentioned the cutting, the editing a little bit. There are a number of strange jump cuts.
Oh, yes.
In motions.
Like, yeah.
We've pulled the pistol out, and we're starting to pull the pistol out, but we don't quite get to where it needs to be. But the next, we have another... frame where we can
batting it out of his hand. Let's cut those two together.
We'll just cut the pistol and the batting together, and it'll be fine. And again, doesn't hold up to repeated viewing.
Again,
works while you're watching it.
Yep,
action film, you know, whatever stuff.
Well, this is the second time that I've seen the movie, and the last time I saw it, I was 9, and I still was able to point it out.
True, but again, all right, so yeah. That, and then the scene when Pris is fighting with Deckard.
Oh, yeah.
Which, is much shorter than I remember it being the last time I watched it.
True.
When she gets shot and starts bouncing around,
yeah,
that image, for some reason, has always been very disturbing to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know why, other than it seems to me that she is fighting, she's fighting so hard against dying.
Yeah.
That it's not, it's like she's throwing a temper tantrum about having been shot.
Yeah.
Not so much that she's in pain, although obviously there's that element mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
But that she's actually like a 4-year-old.
Like complaining that she's
complaining that she has to go to bed and throwing a tantrum on the floor, bouncing around and kicking and screaming and bashing, except that she's also dying.
All right,
and that just sticks with me. I mean, even when I haven't watched the movie in a while, every once in a while I get a you know like that scene with that thing and
well
think, you know.
Well, the thing about Ridley Scott, and that's in just in his kind of his filmmaking, I mean, Alien, he did kind of the same thing in Alien, you know, he used the set as a way to, kind of enhance whatever was going on in the scene. I mean, mm-hmm. in Alien, you know, he used, shadows to kind of hide what this monster mm-hmm. actually looked like, so it built up in your brain. He used, you know, strobe lights and, you know, like, dust and just all this crazy stuff while she was thrashing around to kind of enhance, like, that this is something that is going on. And mm-hmm. honestly, I think it looked like something that was pulled out of a horror movie.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was kind of just like she's convulsing and, you know, clearly dying, but, you know, it's one of those things where she's convulsing and she's dying and, you know, this is obviously a very, very dramatic scene and all that good stuff. And, he used the kind of the setting around him around the actress to kind of enhance the dying, because if she got shot, like in the street,
mm-hmm.
kind of like what happened with the other,
with the dancer,
you know, was that really did you really feel anything when she got shot?
No,
not at all. You didn't feel a damn thing.
And I felt even less when the voiceover told me that he felt bad about shooting a woman in the back.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, okay, I've been like arguing this in my head. Are the replicants, are they lab grown, but they're programmed? Are they like the augmented humans from Wrath of Khan, or are they robots?
It's not clear.
Okay, because they were robots that were like humans in the book, but mm-hmm. in the movie, because they were talking about like genetic like cell stages, and you know, after day two of, you know, cell regeneration.
I believe the implication is in the film that they are grown.
Yeah,
and that they are grown rapidly.
Right,
and then they grow to their adult size in a matter of days or weeks.
Yeah,
and then they are implanted with experience now, or they are implanted with information that they need in order to perform their function.
So, are they essentially accelerated clones? They're grown to their adult stage, and then they're imprinted, and then they are just put out into the world?
I believe so. I believe that would be.
That's... Actually, that kind of makes me feel bad that, you know, they would do that.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah. Well, that's depressing.
You're feeling bad for an artificial...
I'm feeling bad for an artificial life form. I really didn't think that this would happen. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's weird.
That's why it works that... Okay. Spoiler alert.
Oh, God.
Roy Batty dies.
You don't say!
But he's not killed.
Yeah.
Unlike many other films, many films before and many films since...
Yeah.
The bad guy isn't dispatched by the hero in this film.
Matter of fact.
And that, I have to say, I truly love about this film. I love that there is no final coup de grace or whatever. You know, there is no bad guy hanging from the rafter falling into the river. There is
Matter of fact, it's the opposite in this particular movie.
And yeah, in fact, yes, the final scenes of this film, or the final scenes of the actual fight that Batty and Deckard have through this abandoned building, uh-huh, ending on the roof. It's so satisfying.
Yeah.
That he just dies.
Yeah.
There isn't Deckard finding his gun and shooting him, or finding somehow a way to get it. They didn't manage to bring the girl back to the rooftop, somehow get her there, or put her in jeopardy in some way with a hostage situation, or, you know, make it so that Deckard has to say something witty in order to dispatch him with aplomb, just to fire his pistol at him and say, you know, "So long, Screwy.
Retired.
Or something." Yeah. Retired. Retired. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bang. Retired.
Yeah.
You know, unlike Arnold Schwarzenegger films, which were...
Yeah. What killed the dinosaurs? The Ice Age!
Which were soon to be...
Batman and Robin.
Soon to be a popular thing after the following year. So, you know, there is... It is a credit to Ridley Scott, to the screenwriters, to, well, even the production, the producers, who had changed many things in this film.
Apparently. Yeah, that's the other thing. They changed so much.
How did they not order a reshoot to have that dude shot instead of just
letting him die,
dying like that? Maybe that was one of the things that they felt worked. Huh. I don't know. But, yeah. And speaking of dying, no, I'm not really going to speak of dying anymore. So I think we talked this one out.
Yeah, we did.
I think we got. I think we squeezed quite a bit out of it.
Oh, one last thing.
Oh,
just one more thing. I think that that the world that they built with this movie, they could conceivably come back to it. And they could make another movie in it, don't you think? I mean, maybe not.
Could have. I don't think you could now.
You don't think so?
I don't know that I would want that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's been 30 years.
Yeah.
So there's that. You'd have to answer the question as to whether Deckard was a replicant.
I don't want that answered, though. Well, I mean...
No, we do want that answer.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. We
want
people to send email to wonderedofsomething@gmail.com.
Oh, God.
Or tweet at us at Mr. Bowen, or at @_fro. And then, there you go. That's what we want about that.
Yeah.
So, no, I don't think that you could come back to this story. First of all, because with the way films are... You know, you would have to go buck against some very serious trends, uh-huh, in order to bring a movie of the quality of Blade Runner to the screen now, especially in something, because it would cost you so much money in order to make, to replicate that that landscape and that. You know,
yeah.
Because it, I don't know, maybe you could. All right, Hollywood, I challenge you. Make Blade Runner 2, only not with Harrison Ford, and don't reboot the franchise. Write another story set in the same landscape.
Yeah, that's what I want to see. I want to
do something like that.
Yeah, I want to see
Harrison
a movie.
Ford's gone. He's out. You know, mm-hmm, he's off to his thing. Follow up with Gaff. Find out what's going on with him.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably got a longer beard. Probably building bigger animals now. And maybe his limp has gotten a little worse. And hey, you've got the cachet of Edward James Olmos now. This guy's got four seasons of Battlestar Galactica under his belt.
That's true,
and,
yeah.
You know, countless other films and things, but...
Make him the police chief.
Make him the police chief.
Yeah.
And then...
He's brown-nosing for a promotion for most of his life. Give him that promotion.
Get yourself some hard-nosed guys who can pull off noir dialogue. I don't know. How about you get Seth MacFarlane for the witty sidekick, okay. And you put John Hamm.
John Hamm.
Sure, why not?
I'm saying
his name right? Right?
Yeah, that's
right.
I think.
Okay.
It's with two M's, right?
I believe it is with two M's. I think I drew it out enough.
Good.
Or any number of other people, but and write yourself, and then get Chris Nolan to direct it.
Christopher Nolan?
And then you can have... Yeah, there you go.
All right. Have Ridley Scott be an executive producer, you know.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Sure. Why not? He can oversee it.
And
then have him... And then put that together. But not a reboot.
Not a reboot.
Not a relaunch. Not a whatever else you want to call it. Let's do it. We'll call it Android... We'll call it Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep 2?
Yes.
And we'll put it out in 2016.
That'll be... Let's put it out in 2019.
Yes.
Yes.
There you go. Perfect.
The year that the movie took place, we will have another one that takes place in the exact same time. Alternate universe, that kind of stuff. Yeah? Yeah.
There you go.
I like that idea. Let's do it. Let's go make it.
All right. So that is episode 4 of... the 100 of some movie thing with me, Mr. Bowen, and him, the Fro.
Yes.
And we're on the Twitters, and we're on the email, and you have that all now. So I'm at Mr. Bowen. He's at the_Fro. You can contact us at 100ofsomething@gmail.com, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yes.
There you go.
Bye.
Bye.
But it is.
Blade Runner. If we're bad, he catches you. Blade Runner. If he catches you, you're through.
God damn it.